Muito boa noite. Que oportunidade, que privilégio nós temos essa noite. O nosso convidado é um alemão, é um mestre do cinema mundial, um artista radical que tem como marcas a intensidade, a originalidade e uma audácia próxima à loucura. Ele já bem definiu o verniz do que nós chamamos de civilização como só uma fina camada de gelo sobre um oceano profundo de caos e escuridão. Em 60 anos de carreira, ele fez mais de 70 filmes, esmerando-se em quebrar a superfície gelada para iluminar os abismos da alma humana. Aguirre, A Cólera dos Deuses, Fitzcarraldo e o documentário O Homem-Urso são algumas de suas obras mais celebradas. Os protagonistas dele são sempre sujeitos à fronteira entre delírio e razão, natureza humana em confronto com a natureza selvagem. Como criador, ele se parece com seus personagens. Já plantou sua câmera na Antártida, em vulcões ativos, já desbravou uma caverna selada há 28 mil anos, já comeu o próprio sapato para pagar uma aposta, levou um tiro de ar comprimido numa entrevista ao vivo, e ele é o único diretor da história que se saiba a ter filmado longas nos 5 continentes. E poucos lugares do mundo marcaram tanto sua obra quanto o Brasil. Aqui ele dirigiu filmes, uma peça, uma ópera. O país também é o cenário final do livro que ele está lançando agora, O Crepúsculo do Mundo. Que livro! É um romance histórico, biográfico, que narra a história de Hiro Onoda, o oficial japonês que continuou em combate por 30 anos depois do fim da Segunda Guerra, guerra já acabada, ele irredutível, lá na selva de uma ilhota das Filipinas, se recusava a acreditar que o confronto tinha terminado e continuava em suas batalhas. Um herói tipicamente herzogiano. Pois é, é ele mesmo, nosso convidado de hoje, prestes a completar 80 anos e a lançar um livro de memórias, Werner Herzog está entre nós. Willkommen, Herr Herzog.
Well, yes, I can see you. And I hear you. Thank you.
I have here your book, Das Dämmer der Welt, The Dawn of the World. It's just been released in Brazil right now. It's a precious piece of work. In the first pages, you tell us that it all began with a faux pas, with a gaffe, when the Japanese hosts offered you the highest honor of meeting the emperor, and you declined. And what happened then?
Let's not go too deep into it, because I still want to sink into the ground. Well, I staged an opera, the world premiere, and people in Japan knew what we were doing. It was a modern composer. And so the office of the emperor stretched out feelers whether I could potentially have a private audience with the emperor. And I immediately said, oh my God, it will be all formalities. I do not really know what to say to the emperor. And my Japanese hosts, they were looking at the ground and looking to the side. They didn't look in my eyes anymore. And I knew this was the worst faux pas you can ever, ever commit in Japan. So my heart sank, and it sinks today when I think about it. And then there was silence. And in the middle of the silence, somebody asked, whom else would you then like to meet in Japan? And I said, Onoda. Hiro Onoda. And I met him very soon, and we became some sort of friends. We had very intense conversation.
You didn't film your conversations with Onoda? You just recorded, or you had it filmed
as well? No, I just took a few notes. It's sometimes you do not film things. You just absorb it. You just listen.
And you said that your books will outlast your films. But why did you choose that to write Hiro Onoda's stories and not to make it into a film?
it's very hard to say why. Sometimes I know in my instincts, this is for writing, this is poetry, this is film. And I contemplated for a moment, should it be a film? And I said, no. And I carried this book for long, long years in me. I could have written it 20 years ago or 15 years ago, 5 years ago. And I just finished two new films. And when I was done with it, my wife said, now it's still, you cannot move out with much. Why don't you write? And I immediately wrote. And then I wrote yet another book. So
it didn't take long for you to write. It was already built up inside yourself.
Yes, it was completely, completely there. And of course, while writing, you phrase it sometimes differently, but it is writing. Some of it is like hallucinations, like fever dreams in the jungle. Sometimes it is about a world that we create for ourselves that is fictitious. For Onodar, the war was not a fiction, but he lived in a fictitious war. And every detail he interpreted as a proof that the war was still on. Battleships passing by and warplanes passing over his head in the Philippines. But they went to the next war, to the Korean War. For him, it was clear the war is still on, but the battlefields had shifted further west.
I want to show you something. You might have never seen them, I don't know. Some pictures. Pictures of Onoda, probably in the countryside of São Paulo in 1975, and of him in Mato Grosso do Sul, among his herd, his cattle, in
Such
a being, incredible.
Yeah,
incredible. Is it the first time you see these pictures?
Yes, first time. And when I see his face, I miss him. He was deeply disappointed by Japan. He thought it was all lost in consumerism, that it has lost its soul. And this was the reason why he left for Brazil. And in the Mato Grosso do Sul, he was a cattle rancher. And only part of the year he would return during summer season and teach survival classes to schoolboys, to school kids, I think also girls. So and in my book, I actually write about his cattle in Mato Grosso do Sul. It's the very last sentences speak about his cattle.
If you allow me, I will read the last paragraph. É somente no meio do gado, no Mato Grosso, que Onoda encontra alguma segurança. Seu coração bate no ritmo dos animais, sua respiração respira com eles. Então ele sabe que está onde está. A noite se foi e cardumes de peixe não sabem de nada. I really enjoyed your book, Herzog. It's incredible because it has so many layers. He has this apparent story, but there's so many deeping...
It's purely literature. It reads like a poem. When you read the entire last pages, it's almost like visions, like hallucinations, like fever dreams, like poetry. It's language. It is language. And I truly believe that what I'm writing may have, probably has a longer life than my films. People only see my films, but it's my films are like my voyage. When I'm in the Amazonia and I move a ship over a mountain, this is all my voyage. But when I write, that is home. That's home. That's where my soul lives. And because of that, I think it is, there's a certain force in what I'm writing.
That's really beautiful. Listen, when you relate, when you say your, when you portray yourself as a soldier of cinema, and relating to Onoda, do you feel as lonely as Onoda in this war?
No, but when you are making films and it's not just me, you have to accept a certain amount of solitude. Ultimately, when you are directing a film, you have lots of people around, but the very deep center of what we are doing is solitude. And if you cannot take it, you shouldn't make films and you shouldn't write books.
Listen, Brazil has a prominent place in your work. You shot Fitzcarraldo, Cobra Verde. Do you speak any Portuguese?
I understand Portuguese, and if I spend a month in São Paulo or Rio or Juazeiro do Norte, I would speak it, but I'm completely, I've not spoken it for 30 years or so. It sleeps inside of my heart, in my ear.
Nosso batom preferido acaba de ficar ainda melhor. O novo Power Stay da Avon tem a longa duração que a gente já ama, agora com novas cores e mais conforto para os lábios. São 16 horas sem precisar retocar, com uma sensação mais flexível nos lábios. Ele não gruda, não craquela, não borra e nem desbota. Sim, um mate confortável é possível. Novo batom Power Stay. O dia passa, o power fica ainda mais confortável.
Listen, Mr. Herzog, as a Bavarian, you once compared Bavarians to Brazilians. What do we have in common?
Exuberance of fantasy. The kind of dreaming, the fever dreams, the kind of physical friendship. You see, when you're in America, nobody touches you. But in Brazil, they touch me. Oh, Werner, and they touch my hand. And Werner, come to Bahia. The women are beautiful. Come, and they grab my hand, and they, you see, some
abraços.
Yes. You have to, when you're in Brazil, you have to touch people. Otherwise, you're not in Brazil. And if they do not touch you, if in Brazil they do not touch you, you are not wanted.
Is there any point of contact between Brazilian sense of humor and Bavarian sense of humor? For us, for Brazilians, it's very hard to understand, to see, to actually reckon any sense of humor in German people.
Yes, Bavarians have it, and I have it in many of my films. There is a lot of humor.
Yes, there is.
Very dark. And of course, when you look at Bavaria, we had the last king of Bavaria was Ludwig II, who was insane. And he supported Wagner operas, built himself a cave and a boat, which was taken by swans to the shore. Or he built Neuschwanstein Castle, these dream castles. Now you see it in Disneyland. Disneyland is a cheap replica of what Ludwig II invented, the big fantasies. And he was the one who, not like the Prussians in the north, the emperor was Prussian, they would spend the money in wars, in military. he would spend the money in opera and in castles and in things like that. So that brings me close to Brazil.
You've worked with great Brazilian actors, Grande Otelo, José Lio Goy. Also worked with the singer Milton Nascimento. What are your best memories, your most fond memories of them?
Well, I miss them. And also, well, Rui Guerra is still around. Rui Guerra is also in my film. But such wonderful, wonderful actors. They're more than actors. You see, they are a force of nature. They're all, as a singer, for example, Milton is, of course, a musician like a musician is born like a musician. And he connects with you through music. And Grande Otelo is a short man, but he's like a volcano. Like an active volcano, and he was a force of nature that was incredible, and I loved him. I loved this man, and José Lio Goy, I really loved them all.
I want to show you some moves of another Brazilian force of nature that I know you are very fond of, Garrincha. You once said that Garrincha embodied Brazil, that Garrincha was Brazil to you. We call him the angel with the crooked legs.
Yes. And,
why is Garrincha Brazil for you?
He's the joy of Brazil. He's not only the joy of football. He's the joy of a whole nation. And of course, when you look at his last years, he lived through a tragedy. He's also a very tragic, moment. When I see him, my heart is full of joy. And I love Brazil. Just seeing him, when I have a very dark day, I play some clips of Garrincha to me on YouTube. And sometimes I also feel the pain of people, the tragedy of people. And that's also him. It's very, very deep, and there has never, never, ever been a football player like him. You had great players like Pelé, for example. Pelé is a great athlete, the greatest of athletes and the greatest. And you have had Ronaldinho, the greatest of magicians. And so, but the pure joy of Brazil, that's Garrincha, and the tragedy of a man is also Garrincha.
Germans were involved in one of the Brazil main tragedies, the trauma in the semifinals of 2014, with the infamous loss of 7-1. What did you feel when you were watching that match?
I wish it had ended when Germany scored 2 goals. Then it would have been fine, yes. But What Germany showed as a surprise was a new form of football. Extremely fast, high precision passing, laser football. And nobody was prepared for that. And only in one game they really could show it. And that was unfortunately against Brazil. But it happens. It happens. And it happened to For example, Brazil wins against Italy in penalty shootout.
1994.
Yes, and I will meet here in because I'm nearby. I will meet Franco Baresi, who was a defense because I like him. I like him. He was the one who could read the game, to read the intentions, read the configuration, read what was coming at him. That made him unique. But he was completely different than Garrincha. And I wish, well, it happens. You see, it is a game. It is a game. And the crazy things happen. And Brazil is much better, much, much, much better than Germany now, for example. They come back. They will become world champion again sooner or later. Don't worry about that.
I think we have good chances this year in this strange World Cup in the desert, in the Persian Gulf. You made Aguirre and Fiscaraldo under extreme conditions in the Amazon, and legend goes that the Indians, when they saw the hard time you were having with the great Klaus Kinski, they offered themselves to kill him.
Und du sagst es mir nicht, aber schau aber nicht, leg mich doch am Arsch weg. Denk mal, wenn ich überhaupt bekomme, wo ich dir in die Fresse haue.
Was?
Diesmal schlage ich dir in die Fresse, darauf kannst du dich verlassen, du.
Mach zu.
And I wonder who was running the highest risk of being killed, you by Kinski or Kinski by you?
Well, that's hard to say, but I can tell you what I can tell you a little bit from the perspective of the local tribal people. When Kinski screamed and he destroyed the set and was intimidating and yelling, they were all sitting in a circle. And they would all put their heads together and they whisper. They solved their disputes in very low voice. They would whisper. And after one of these incidents, the chief came to me and he said to me, you are, they called me Matsonzure in their language, which means you are a jaguar, you are a tiger. He said, tiger, you know, do not believe, you saw we were kind of afraid, but do not think we were afraid of this screaming madman. They were afraid of me because I was so silent. They were afraid of me and they were afraid for Kinski because I was so silent. And they said to me, we can kill him for you if you want it. They would have done it within 60 seconds.
And you?
In 60 seconds.
And how did you react to this offer?
No, I told them we are here for work and we are all working on the same project and I still need him. We have not finished shooting yet. So we need him tomorrow and we need him next week. So let's not think about killing him now.
So, was him the greatest actor you've ever directed?
No. The greatest of all was Bruno S., the man who played Kaspar Hauser. And he was not an actor, but nobody had his depth, his tragedy, his incredible presence on a screen that touched your heart. Just seeing him for a moment makes you cry. So it intense is. And so good and so tragic. And sometimes, yeah, well, I think of Nicolas Cage, Bad Lieutenant, completely wild and wonderful. Now, Kinski was a great, great actor.
And with Klaus Kinski, did you keep in touch with him till the end of his life?
No, we separated after we did Cobra Verde. And I said all the facets of his existence, his madness, his exuberance, his intensity, his presence on the screen in various different characters has been explored. There's nothing new to explore with him. So that was one thing. And when we did the last film, Cobra Verde, he was completely out of control and he became physically violent to team members, and I said to him, not on my set. There's no violence against anyone who is in the film, not on my set. It cannot happen again. So, but yeah, he contacted me once for his book. He wrote an autobiography and I helped him a little bit. There's 2 pages nonstop to rant against me. Herzog is stupid and dangerous and vile and whatever and on and on. And he said to me, can you help me? And we looked into dictionaries to find even worse expressions. So I helped him a little bit.
To offend you in the best terms possible, in the worst terms possible.
With the worst, language possible. And but that was, I think, the last time we were together. And then he died only 3 years or 4 years after we did the last film.
Listen, in your work, even when you penetrate, you dive deep into the most somber areas of human condition, close to delirium and madness, you always keep faith on clarity. You keep faithful to clarity. You are never hermetic. Is this a German virtue?
No, it's, I think other filmmakers have it as well. There's something like following a vision. And I have never departed from a deep, deep, deep vision that I had in my films. And clarity, yeah, it's not floating around. I can show things that are deeply dormant inside of us and make it into clarity, like a ship over a mountain. It's a great metaphor. I do not know metaphor for what, but I know it is in many of us. And I make it visible. I'm the first one who makes it visible. Or when Melville writes Moby Dick, the hunt for the white whale, it is a deep image, a vision inside of us. And he makes it, he articulates it in writing in this case. So, and there's a certain clarity about it. And I bring it to clarity inside of you. Inside of the audience.
Because there are artists that they make visible what was invisible, but they don't have as much consideration to the viewer as you have. You take the viewer and the reader into consideration. You want to be understood.
Yes, and also wake up something that is dormant in us. Poetry that is dormant in us, images that are dormant in us. And that's what makes us filmmakers or poets. That's the essence of poetry.
You declared once that you will only watch 3 or 4 films a year. Yeah. What is more important than watching movies to learn how to make cinema?
Well, I have to confess, I only learned from bad films. Great films, I never know how they made it. When I look at Kurosawa Rashomon, 1954 or so, I do not want to figure out what makes this film so great and so incredible. But real bad films, I learn, oh, this is how you should not do it. So, and I want to be somebody who is in the world. I have worked in as a young man, while I was still in school, I worked in a steel factory. I worked as a parking lot attendant at the Oktoberfest, where you have 3,000 drunk people each night to take them out of their cars, if you can. So where there's pura vida. It's pura vida. You live in the world, and I do not want to close my eyes to what the world is all about. And because of that, sometimes I watch trash TV. It's because I understand in what kind of world we are living. But of course, understanding the world is meeting the world, touching the people, and having a Caipirinha with them.
I hope soon we'll have this opportunity.
Yes.
You're about to finish your memories. Are you done with them?
Yeah,
they're finished.
But they're memories, more about memories of ideas. How did a film like Aguirre originate? I do not speak very much about Aguirre, but about basic ideas. One of them would be an African revolutionary in the early 1960s, John Okello, who was a revolutionary on the island of Zanzibar. He declared himself field marshal at the age of 27. And with a few almost unarmed men, he started a revolution and succeeded for a short time. And he delivered the maddest, the most crazy of all speeches you could ever hear over radio. And some of the echo of his speeches you can hear in Aguirre's mad speeches. So it's more about origins of things that come at you. I was with child soldiers in Honduras, Nicaragua, 8, 9, 10-year-old soldiers, I mean real soldiers who died in combat. And all of a sudden in my memoir says, 5 ballads of the little soldier. And it's not biographical. It's more about the child soldiers.
There's an adjective that follows you. Fearless. Writing your memories. You're about to turn 80. Writing your memories. Did you find out what really scares you?
No, because it's not in my dictionary. The man who frightens me has to be born yet.
Vladimir Putin.
Let's not talk about him, I know everybody speaks at the moment about him. And of course, I'm against war. I grew up in ruins, so I know what war does.
And your wife is Russian, right? Your wife is a Russian artist.
She's American. She moved to America 28 years ago, and mm-hmm. She's an American citizen. And she was never conformist in in Soviet times. As a 15, she grew up with literature, great literature. And as a 15-year-old girl, she hand-copied forbidden books like Master and Margarita by Bulgakov. 400.
I loved it.
Yes, 400 pages, but in handwriting. Because he
wow.
Many copies. And she would secretly pass it along her friends. And then she hand-copied the first book of Solzhenitsyn, not the Gulag, it came later. It's a day in the life of Ivan Denisevich. But it's a shorter text. It's only 170, 180 pages. And so she was never conformist. So good for her.
Werner, thank you so much for your generosity, for having us for this time. And we do recommend the reading of O Crepúsculo do Mundo, a gente recomenda, de Werner Herzog, livro, uma pequena joia, imperdível. O Crepúsculo do Mundo, de Werner Herzog. Obrigado, até a próxima. Thank you so much, Werner. It was great.
Thank you. One day I hope to see you and we'll have a caipirinha and arm around each other.
Yes, take care.
My salute to Brazil. Okay,
all the best. Bye-bye. Quer ver mais? Entre no Globoplay.